From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the MSU dean who worked with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who saw King's calmness in the face of danger.
He said John Fitzgerald had the Secret Service, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and the Coast Guard all under his command, and they got him. And when they're ready for me, they're going to get me. And I'm not afraid.
The latest in the federal redistricting lawsuit in Michigan.
There's no question, given how early in the election cycle it is, that there's a very real possibility that there will be different maps for 2020 than we have now.
The Michigan scientist who's a legend in the world of UFOs.
He is absolutely the reason you know the words Area 51.
And we will celebrate squirrels. Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello there, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On this Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we will hear from Robert Green, a friend and associate of Dr. King.
As Martin Luther King Jr. would say, we yet have a lot to do and a long ways to go. The fair treatment of everyone in America must be a major goal.
But first, last November, Michigan voters approved creating a new Citizen Redistricting Commission. The job? To redraw congressional and legislative districts. The new maps won't be in place until 2022. But some districts could see changes much sooner, before the 2020 election, thanks to a pending settlement of a federal gerrymandering lawsuit. This suit alleges political bias in the district lines drawn for the U.S. House districts, as well as both the state Senate and state House. Here now to walk through the implications of all of this is Zach Gorchow. He's editor of Gongwer News. And before we get to the possible settlement, Zach, give us a refresher on this lawsuit itself. Who are the plaintiffs here and what are they alleging?
So the main plaintiff is the League of Women Voters, but then you also have several individual Democratic voters represented by Mark Brewer, the former Michigan Democratic Party chair. And they're alleging that Michigan's maps for the Michigan House, Michigan Senate, and the state's 14 U.S. House districts are drawn in such a way that they so heavily favor Republicans that it is violating various constitutional rights, things like equal protection, due process, so forth, in effect denying their right to choose their representatives.
And as I recall, some emails among Republicans as they drew up these district maps kind of emerged last year with some rather blunt talk. Remind us what we learned in those emails.
Well, those emails, which came about as a result of the discovery process in the lawsuit, really served to confirm what was always suspected, which was that Republicans drew the maps to favor Republicans. It just put a very fine point on it. I mean, you had the one staffer who boasted about how they had, quote, crammed all the Dem garbage into one congressional district. And by doing that, that enabled them to make other surrounding districts more Republican-leaning.
So what happened to this lawsuit when GOP Secretary of State Ruth Johnson was replaced at the start of this month with Democratic Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson?
So the named defendant in the case was Ruth Johnson, the Secretary of State. Once she left office and Jocelyn Benson took office, Jocelyn Benson becomes named defendant in the case. And Jocelyn Benson has been very outspoken about partisan gerrymandering. And everyone sort of looked at this and said, hey, she could look to settle this case and settle it on terms that the plaintiffs would really want and what Democrats would really want and Republicans would not. So she has the main control right now as the named defendant. Now, there are some Republican legislators and members of Congress who have been granted intervening status as defendants by the federal courts. So they're going to have a role to play here, too. And they're arguing right now in court that a settlement cannot be made without their participation. This is going to be fascinating to see how the courts handle this.
Well, yeah, because we have Republicans claiming that this proposed settlement is being worked out in secret. And they say they weren't invited. And the Secretary of State's attorney said, oh, yes, they were. They chose not to participate. Is this a taste of what divided government in Michigan is going to be like?
Well, yes. I mean, I think, you know, we're seeing right now, you know, despite all of the sort of happy talk that's been going on the first few weeks of the year, you know, here's an example where the proverbial rubber meets the road. And let me tell you, if there's a settlement that involves a consent decree from this federal judicial panel directing the legislature to redraw the lines, something which Governor Whitmer would have to sign, let's just say that's not going to be the most kumbaya moment that the legislature is going to see for the next 2 years. That's going to be an extremely acrimonious partisan process.
So we know late last week Secretary of State Benson filed motions asking the federal court in Detroit to basically hit the hold button on this lawsuit, that there could be this proposed settlement agreement. Do we know what's in it?
No. There's a lot of unanswered questions here. Number one, who draws the lines? Is it going to be drawn up by the plaintiffs and Jocelyn Benson, subject to court approval? Is it going to be a directive that the legislature redraw the lines, but that the plaintiffs have to approve and the court has to approve? Do they go to the Michigan Supreme Court, which typically in the past has been sort of a backstop if the legislature and the governor can't agree on lines? So that's a big unknown that has to be resolved. And I will say that there is, even though the people who organized the redistricting ballot proposal have said they don't believe the redistricting commission would be activated as a result of this, I have talked to a couple attorneys who aren't so sure about that, that, you know, under the Constitution now, after this proposal was adopted, redistricting goes to the commission. It's been taken away from the legislature. Now, that said, if a federal judge orders the legislature to draw the lines, that trumps Michigan constitutional law. But I wouldn't totally rule out the idea that the commission process could be activated. It sounds like it's a very, very low probability. But I have talked to some attorneys who say, hey, the legislature is not in charge anymore of redistricting.
So isn't there this potential ripple effect? Let's say you withdraw, you redraw one political boundary, and you're then redrawing the district right next to it. I mean, it's just...
Yeah. They've challenged a specific set of districts. And I'm just going to mention a couple because they're relatively easy to explain. You've got districts for the Michigan House in the Muskegon and Saginaw areas. And right now, the way those districts are drawn, the suburban districts lean pretty well Republican. But then you have the core center city districts, which, you know, would be the cities of Muskegon, the city of Saginaw, and their inner ring suburbs. Those are heavily, heavily Democratic. You could easily, I think, redraw those districts to put some of those inner ring suburbs with what's now the suburban district. Basically, you're trying to parcel out some of those Democratic voters that are now so concentrated into what are Republican-leaning districts, and doing that would tilt them more toward 50-50 type things. That's what the plaintiffs are going for here.
What would be the limitations that Republican legislators would be working with if this pending settlement is approved?
Well, I think almost certainly they're going to have to get some type of Democratic sign-off, whether that's from Governor Whitmer, whether it's from the plaintiffs in this case. They can't do this on their own. They're not simply going to be able to do what they did in 2011, which is draw these up in secret and have them rubber stamped in the legislature, you know, with no meaningful public input, and rushed through and to become law. That this will have to be done with approval from some type of Democratic entity.
What do you expect this will all mean for the political calculus for 2020 on both sides of the aisle?
Well, this could be an incredibly consequential election. You know, right now, the Michigan Senate is not up for election in 2020. Well, I think there's a pretty good chance the plaintiffs are going to argue that there should be elections for the Senate in 2020 for two-year terms based on these new boundaries. That will certainly be litigated and fought over. But if that happens, if the Senate is up for election, you will have the whole legislature up in 2020 in a presidential year, and there's a chance that, you know, the Democrats could flip both houses with these new redrawn maps, which would be fair to them, and you could have the potential for total democratic control of state government. I mean, there will be an immense amount at stake if that happens. Now, if the Senate gets exempted from this, you know, then it's less dramatic. The House was going to be up for election anyways. The maps would presumably become better for Democrats than they are now, and it would enhance their chances of winning control of the House. That said, though, the Senate would remain Republican if the Senate is not ordered to stand for election.
So, meantime, we've got this motion challenging the right of the parties to go into negotiations. So they have to fight over the settlement talks and then see where it goes from there.
Right. I mean, we don't, you know, the Republican intervening defendants, that's two members of the legislature and several members of Congress, are saying we have to be a part of settlement negotiations. And there's no doubt in my mind that if there is a settlement that's only between Secretary of State Benson and the plaintiffs, which are Democrats, that that will be challenged and appealed. And there will likely be a lengthy court process that plays out after this. But there's no question, given how early in the election cycle it is, that there's a very real possibility that there will be different maps for 2020 than we have now.
Zach Gorchow, Gongra News Service. It's never boring talking politics in Michigan, is it?
Good to be with you.
Thanks very much. On this Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we wondered, how would Dr. King feel about America today? We sent our reporters around the state to ask people that question.
I think that he would still have hope in it. He would still be trying to advocate for all of us to get along, but he would not be naive to see what's going on and see the racial tension that is happening. So I think he would still be doing what he was doing back then, trying to put us all back together, but it would be tough still.
I think he would be encouraged from the standpoint that I think this is the way all civilizations work. There are great strides and then there are great setbacks. But the thing is whether or not you can overcome the setbacks, and the field of activism, it's greater than it's ever been. I mean, I was alive in the 60s and it's greater than it was then.
I think he'd be very sad that we haven't made as much progress as we should have. I hate to say it, we still have white privilege, we still have segregation, even though it's not as blatant as it used to be, it is still there. It seems like we're going backwards a lot instead of forward. It's sad. Our country is not where it should be in all the years that we've had.
That was Jameer Diebel from Grand Rapids, LaGina Kennedy from Detroit, and Serena Bowden from Grand Rapids. You're listening to Stateside. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Happy National Squirrel Appreciation Day. Let's give a hat tip to those perky little mammals that scamper around our neighborhoods, our parks, and our forests. Here now from Hope College, where she's a biology professor, is Dr. Kathy Winnett Murray. Through the years, as part of her animal behavior classes, she's conducted squirrel investigations on and near the Hope campus. So, Kathy, what do we have to learn from squirrels?
Well, I think we have a lot to learn from squirrels about getting along in our very own neighborhoods. One of the reasons I'm interested in them in my animal behavior class is that they're eager to participate in class observational experiments, so they have the right personalities. And we investigate how animals are adapted to make decisions based on what I think are essentially economic cost-benefit relationships. In ecology, we call this optimality theory. But basically, it's how much energy is put in for how much energy out, or how much bang for the buck. For example, a squirrel who can't balance those things with sound decision-making might not make it through the winter, or they might not successfully avoid a predator such as a hawk or a coyote.
So give us an idea of what you do during these investigations with your students. Sitting outside and just kind of, do you have certain spots? What are you watching them do?
Well, we usually use the Hope College campus because our squirrels are very eager to participate, as I mentioned. One example is we're looking at whether behavioral decisions reflect knowledge of their food. So, for example, you know that all autumn long, squirrels are going around scatter hoarding nuts for the winter, but they also have to eat and put on extra fat to help survive the winter. So we use pecans and a really interesting observational experiment where we're looking at whether they, if they have a choice of a perishable or a non-perishable food, will they make decisions based on those relative costs and benefits. We use pecans in the shell. We create perishable pecans by punching a hole with a nail. Presumably the squirrels can recognize that those nuts are compromised by smelling them. And then we set up feeding stations around campus, and my students observe from a distance and watch what the squirrels decide to do with these two kinds of nuts that we put in little kitty dishes. Most of the intact non-perishable pecans the squirrels take and they bury them right away. And the perishable ones, which we think they're learning by through smell, are they either eat right away or they take them up into the trees, we think maybe to eat soon thereafter. And they spend a lot of time deciding what to do with each nut because a pecan is a big prize for a squirrel.
Do you think squirrels are smarter than most people think they are?
I do. I think they're weighing these cost-benefit relationships, maybe not in a conscious manner, but as an adaptation for getting along in their environment. They have to be able to make decisions based on the context that changes from season to season or what kind of predators are around.
What is your very favorite thing based on all this time you've spent investigating and observing squirrels? What's your favorite thing about squirrels?
My favorite thing about squirrels is that they're right outside the window, to tell you the truth. I love observing nature, but I can be at home, I can be at work, and I can watch squirrels carrying out their lives. I can watch them raising their families. I can watch them doing acrobatics, trying to problem solve at bird feeders. So they're a great reminder that we share the neighborhood with a lot of other creatures, and that we can get along with other creatures pretty easily, just with a little mutual respect.
Hope College biology professor Kathy Winnett-Murray. Well, happy National Squirrel Appreciation Day to you, Professor.
Thank you very much.
It's like something a Hollywood screenwriter might have conjured. U.S. scientists examining and reverse engineering a crashed alien spacecraft, studying the bodies of the extraterrestrials at a secret U.S. Air Force facility. In 1989, a man named Bob Lazar went public with claims that this is exactly what was happening at Area 51, a name for that secret facility in the desert, and said he worked on the alien spacecraft. Today, Bob Lazar lives in mid-Michigan, where he runs a scientific supply company. And he's the focus of a new documentary from investigative filmmaker Jeremy Kenyon Lockyer Corbell and narrated by actor Mickey Rourke. The film, Bob Lazar, Area 51 and Flying Saucers.
This story is extraordinary, especially if it's true. And it all started in the desert, just north of Las Vegas.
A local scientist who's worked at Groom Lake,
said to be where top secret weapon systems have been tested over the years.
He has asked that his identity be shielded.
Exactly what's going on up there?
What's going on up there could be the most important event in history. Physical contact and proof from another system, another planet, another intelligence.
Jeremy is with us now via Skype. Pleasure to welcome you to Stateside, Jeremy.
Thanks so much, Cynthia, for having me on.
In this world of UFOs and extraterrestrials, how important is this guy who runs a scientific supply company in Langsburg, Michigan?
Right. Bob Lazar is kind of the Elvis of ufology. He's the guy that everybody has tried to talk with for about 30 years, and it's been very difficult. He hasn't been very forward and out in the public's eye. An investigative reporter, George Knapp, who's my mentor in journalism, he broke the story in 1989, but it was very difficult all these years to really get to know who is Bob Lazar, the guy that made these explosive claims.
And as we see in your film, you make heavy use of that on-camera interview that Bob did back in 1989. Tell us, why did he decide to talk then, more than 30 years after the work he said he was doing at Area 51?
Yeah, so originally in 1989, whether you believe it or not, it is true. Bob Lazar came forward to protect himself. He was under threat. At that point, he was getting personal threats because of the work that he was doing and his personal life and what occurred right after that. He showed people the test flights on three occasions from a distance over Papoose Lake, which is a sub area of Area 51 people didn't even really know about back then. So he came forward really to protect himself. He was convinced by George Knapp that it would protect him to get in front of. If he just said it all at one time, then there's nothing else that could be held against him.
So he sets it all out to George Knapp and then goes silent. Why did he agree to talk to you some 30 years later?
My charming personality, obviously. But no, he was a, you know, I think I convinced him. I think after 30 years of people disemboweling his story and perverting it and changing it, inserting their fiction and their fantasy, I think enough is enough. I think I was able to convince him that the history books would be written with false information if he didn't come forward again and show people really who he is in his daily life and be clear on what exactly it is that he's claiming.
So without blowing the reason you want people to watch your film, Jeremy, give us a sense of sort out the truth from all the hyperbole and all the fiction that is built up around this man. What is it? What do you believe he did for the government?
Right. Well, we pretty much know for sure that Bob Lazar is a scientist, a physicist, and that he was employed in 1989 to work at a secret base just south of Groom Lake on the Area 51 complex, a site called S4. And there, he was tasked with reverse engineering or back engineering alien propulsion. So a propulsion system based on gravity wave amplification and a very special super heavy element called element 115 in a stabilized form. This was his claim and remains his claim that that was his job, that it was an impossible task, but that that was his job, was to work on the power and the propulsion of a flying saucer that we have 9 of at this base just south of Groom Lake in Area 51. It's wild.
It is. It is. So as you sat there and you looked at him and you talked with him and dug into this with him, how convinced are you that what Bob is saying is true? I mean, and how close did you get to proving it?
Right. So look, this is a nuts and bolts story. This is not about belief. It's either true or it's not true. Our government is either attempting to reverse engineer alien spacecraft or they're not. I think looking at Bob's story now, I mean, the problem with Bob, why his story won't go away is because it's really hard to dismiss him. You watch him. I mean, he passed 4 polygraph tests. You watch him. Not only do you want to believe him, you get the sense he's telling the truth. And it's very frustrating to your worldview. Now, are we ever going to prove it definitively? I mean, unless somebody walks me into that base, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. But we've come very close through the breadcrumbs of his story over 30 years. Things have occurred over these 30 years that weren't possible to know before. For example, I found the individual and got on the phone with the individual who did the security clearance for Bob to work at the base. That couldn't have been done 30 years ago when George Knapp was trying because of just, you know, time, the envelope of time gave us more opportunity. Bob also knew about this hand scanner that everybody thought was, you know, fiction. It was made up. Well, those photos were just declassified, and I was able to show that indeed there is a scanner, a biometric scanner, was used at that time, just like he said, and everybody mocked him for it. So all these little things I've been able to kind of parse and find out over these 30 years, and having Bob talk to me directly on camera for the viewer, I mean, it's pretty amazing. I think it's hard to dismiss Bob. I think to minimize a message, you dehumanize the messenger. And that's what people have tried to do for 3 decades. But now I think, you know, we took the mic back, telling this story clear and as Bob wants it, you know, told, which is direct.
That actually was a moment that stuck with me as I watched your film, was his reaction when you put down these declassified photos of this scanner that he said, oh my gosh. I mean, that was he could not have, it was a very believable reaction. Let me just say that.
Well, because it was real. I mean, people always talk about this story like it was a believable reaction, and I get that. But let me tell you, you're seeing it as it's unfolding in my documentary. This is what happened. Bob's one rule for me to totally insert myself into his life. I mean, give me that box full of tapes. I'm going to get them digitized, you know, these 30-year-old tapes. Mm-hmm. He let me into his life completely, you know, which is against his nature. But the one restriction he had on me is I can't make anything up. I can't sensationalize a story that is already sensational. So really, it was the easiest documentary in the world. I just had to show you what I saw. And that moment is powerful. He is so surprised to to be vindicated, to see this hand scanner that he had talked about for almost three decades and people thought it was laughable. Turns out he was right. How did he know?
Tell us a little about Bob Lazar's, what he tells you he thought when he first set eyes on this spacecraft that he was working with. What did it look like? What did he think?
Okay, yeah. So this is really fascinating. Bob is so analytical. He was given a whole bunch of briefings before he actually saw his first disc. And, you know, he looked through the briefings and they were saying wild things. I mean, talking about another civilization, another species of being that came from another star system. And he didn't know what to think about this. He's a rocket guy, an engine guy, a propulsion guy. But he walks up, he sees the disc for the first time, and the first thought that crosses his mind on this secret base in Nevada, the first thought is, wow, this is what everybody talked about, flying saucers. But wow, they're ours. We made them. He thought people were silly for believing in UFOs. However, when he stepped inside the craft to look at a part of the propulsion system, when he actually stepped inside the flying saucer, that's when he said it felt ominous because the seating was about half the size that you would have for a normal sized human.
You know, one of the questions that's kind of comes to mind in your film and things written about Bob Lazar is, so here's this guy that was employed as a physicist with this task. How did he get access to all of the kind of documentation? Why was he chosen?
Right. And so this is one of the big question marks. Look, the detractors, the first thing they go after to try to dismiss Bob's story is his unprovable education. He claimed that he attended classes at Caltech and MIT, neither of which have record of him. So you have this issue here. You've got a very smart person. We cannot, for 30 years, we cannot prove his education. Yet I have proven, and has George Knapp back in 1989, definitively, Bob Lazar worked at Los Alamos as a physicist. I actually interviewed and got on record another physicist who was in security briefings with Bob Lazar. Didn't know anything about UFOs. He just remembers Bob Lazar from that time. So we know he got a really smart guy who's got incredible abilities. We can't prove his education. Some people say, well, this is part of the setup. You know, maybe it's a catch and release. You know, they wanted to show somebody all this stuff and slowly try to leak some of it out. And Bob admits maybe he's the perfect patsy for all of that. But what he is firm on is that this technology exists. He saw it. He used his own hands. He dismantled it. That's very different than anything he read in the briefings about aliens or this sort of thing. He actually physically worked on a gravity wave amplification system powered by element 115. This is incredible stuff. So Bob really separates what he read from what he had his physical hands on, one flying saucer, one craft, which is extraordinary enough if you believe Bob Lazar. But that's the delineation. That's the difference with Bob Lazar. He knows what he worked on. He was told a lot of stuff, read a lot of briefings that had to do with other programs associated with his power and propulsion program, such as biology, that kind of thing. But he can't prove that part.
One of the things that struck me as I watched your film is the normal everyday life of Bob Lazar at home, going to work at his company. Do you think his neighbors in mid-Michigan would have any sense that this guy is kind of, like you say, he's kind of so central to the UFOlogy culture?
Yeah, I guess I didn't explain that well enough. I mean, he is absolutely the reason you know the words Area 51. I mean, Bob Lazar is the icon with his Coke bottle glasses. I was in India and I found a kid that was selling chai and he was talking about UFOs and he lifted his hands by his eyes and jiggled his hands like Coke bottle glasses. Hmm. He says, Bob Lazar. I mean, he's famous all around the world. The standard flying saucer we know about is, you know, kind of iconicized into popular culture. That's because of Bob Lazar. They mention part of what he told in things like The X-Files and Independence Day. There's a Bob Lazar character. There's Area 51 beef jerky. There's shot glasses of Area 51. It's, you know, it's incredible how this has permeated popular culture because of Bob Lazar. And yeah, that's, he's had some incredible impact. But yet the people in his daily life, they know what he went through. It was painful. It was difficult. It was not a good feeling. They weren't good times. It brings up terrible memories. I mean, in fact, when I showed Bob the film, the first cut, I mean, I thought he was going to hightail it. You know, he absolutely, it brought up all these negative, you know, memories for him. So no, the people in his life, the average people in his life, they don't even talk about UFOs with Bob. To them, he's just Bob.
Does he still feel as though he is under siege? Is he feel as though he's being watched? Did he have any trepidation about coming forward and kind of digging all this back up again?
Yeah, well, there's a very dramatic moment in my movie, which everybody can see. And again, that happened. That actually happened, what you see in my movie. So the joke was, after 30 years, who cares what he has to say? He is kind of done with it. He figured there's very little monitoring done on his life by any of the agencies. I mean, however, he was raided by multiple agencies while in New Mexico under very, very dubious circumstances. You know, we thought that was very strange, but we thought there was nobody listening. We thought nobody cared. Well, on one of the last filmings I did at his house, the next day, his business was raided by the FBI right there in Michigan, and actually was raided by multiple federal agencies. And, you know, they had 25, 26 forensic collection agents looking for paperwork was the official thing that they said. It didn't quite stand up, you know, to why they would have so many agencies there. And it got even weirder. And you'll see that in my film. So, yeah, I think there is some interest, obviously, from government agencies in if Bob Lazar is telling the truth and if indeed he did get a piece of the fuel source, a stable form of Element 115 out of Los Alamos, where it was machined in 1989. That would be something.
Jeremy Corbell, his latest film is Bob Lazar, Area 51 and Flying Saucers. Jeremy, thank you for sharing your work with us and thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me on. It's a real pleasure. And I just hope that everybody that hears this, their curiosity is weaponized.
We will hear from a colleague of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. coming up next. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This is, of course, Martin Luther King Jr. Day, a chance to celebrate the birthday and the life of the Baptist minister who became the most visible leader of America's civil rights movement. His leadership laid the groundwork for landmark civil rights legislation and social change. So how would Martin Luther King Jr. feel about America today? We sent reporters around the state to ask that question.
I think he would be very disappointed in the overall political structure. He'd probably be happy that we've made lots of progress as far as moving into different areas that were closed to him in 68 and 67. But today, it seems like we've gone backwards within the last couple of years, and I think he'd be very disappointed in that.
Well, I think a big part of him would probably be pleased at the progress. I think we still have a long way to go, but relatively speaking, I think we've come a long way since his time when they were so discriminated against. So,
I think he'd be disappointed right now. Our country is getting very polar. I mean, and the country is very divided. All you have to do is look at the politics, and heck, we have a difference of opinion right in our own household. And I think he could help bring everybody together, kind of like he got us to recognize the Afro-Americans and whatever. I mean, I've seen it before, being older like I am. We need somebody like a Martin Luther King to bring us back together.
He would be disappointed. He was a pusher for change. And we have a lot of problems in this country now. And I don't think he would like it at all.
He would let us know that we are better than we have demonstrated. And in spite of all that is happening lately in our country, there's enough in our history to show we can get past these challenging times.
I think on a positive side, he would be encouraged by people in my generation, which is the millennial generation, and he would be encouraged by all of the sort of like group efforts with organizations like Black Lives Matter and nonprofits working in communities, kind of like the Commons where I work, organizing to basically make their communities better and impact what they can impact.
That was George Byard from Grand Rapids, Mary and Jim Coriel from Bel Air, Carol Lynn from Detroit, and Taylor Hartman from Grosse Pointe Park. Now, reflections about Dr. King and his work from a man who knew and worked alongside him. Robert Green is Dean Emeritus at Michigan State University and the former Education Director of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. He was a student at San Francisco State University when he first met Martin Luther King Jr., and that was in June 1956.
Well, see, I was working for Yellow Cab part-time and while going to school. I was able to, on my lunch break, park the cab, walk through a mob of people. I worked my way through as cab drivers could do well at that time. And he had spoken. And I went up to him and introduced myself and said hello. And I told him I wanted to one day work with him. And so I was working part-time and going to school. I think at the time I was working, that was 56, I was working on my bachelor's degree. And I told him that I wanted to work with him one day. He said, well, you keep going to school. And when you finish your education, contact me and we'll, you know, perhaps get together. Now, I want to fact check just a minute, back up just a little. I got there a little earlier before walking down the aisle. So I did hear part of the speech. I want to correct that. Remember, I'm telling you about things that happened 55 years ago.
Absolutely.
So I did part of the speech, and I was just amazed at how eloquent and direct and how committed he was at that time to social justice, because I had been following him in the newspaper and the news media, especially with his social justice work in the state of Alabama.
And he said to you, go get your education and call me. And you did. You later wound up earning a PhD at Michigan State University. You became the first Black member of the faculty at James Madison College. And you were part of bringing Dr. King to the MSU campus in February of 1965. What do you remember about that day?
I remember picking him up at the airport. And we had a nice chat and we reflected on the past. And he said, young man, you need to come work with me soon. I said, well, I would consider working with you because I respect what you're doing. And most important of all, you're teaching people committed to democracy and social justice not to be afraid to work for freedom. And that had an impact. So I told him I would consider it. I think John Hanna, you might want to check this out, was president of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission at that time.
And I'm seeing here in the MSU archives, John Hanna was president of MSU from 1941 to 1969 and chairman of the Commission on Civil Rights from 1957 to 1964. So this would have been the year after that, 1965.
Yes. Martin Luther King Jr. was very impressed that the president of the university was also chairman of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, with some other very distinguished national people.
So you spent 14 months as the education director.
Yeah, about that time, full time.
Yes.
And then off and on for up until his death.
With the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And you tell a very, very powerful story, Dean Green, in your book, At the Crossroads of Fear and Freedom. Tell us the story about being in the South when you were in the car with Dr. King and Andrew Young, and you saw firsthand how Dr. King, in your view, was not afraid to die.
James Belk, the owner of the Texaco station, I believe it was Grenada, was known as a very mean, angry man who did not like blacks or whites who were committed to social justice. And people were kind of fearful of him. Well, his gas station was on the corner. Coretta Scott King's cousin, we call him Oz, was driving, and he stopped at the light. Belk was pumping gas, and he saw the car, he saw Dr. King, had rolled the window down and had his elbow kind of hanging out the window, which he loved to do. Belk stopped pumping his gas, and he went up to Martin Luther King Jr., pulled out a looked like a .38, put it on his temple, and said, Martin Luther King Jr., I'm going to blow your so-and-so brains out. And King didn't flinch. He turned to James Belk with a smile and said, brother, I love you. And Belk was stunned that King wasn't fearful, that he gave the expression, I love you. He said, brother, I love you. I never will forget that. And the pistol came slowly down, and he walked slowly back to the car and continued pumping gas. All of us were really stunned and fearful. And Andy Young, Ambassador Andrew Young in Atlanta, was the only one who called him Martin. We all call him Dr. King. We respected him so much. I had a PhD, but didn't matter. I still call him Dr. King. Andy said, "Martin, you're going to get us all killed." And he turned around and smiled at Andy and said, "Look, say Andrew." He called him Andrew. "Andrew, let me tell you something." He said, "John Fitzgerald had the Secret Service, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and the Coast Guard all under his command, and they got him. And when they're ready for me, they're going to get me, and I'm not afraid." That made such an impression on me that I knew that this was a man who was not going to allow threats or any kind of danger deter him for his work in the area of social justice and brutality and the denial of voting rights in the South for a large segment of the American population who happened to be, at that time, we were called Negroes.
I'm with Dr. Robert Green, the Dean Emeritus of Michigan State University and former Education Director of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, as we go through his memories of working with and knowing Dr. Martin Luther King. When you look at the civil rights movement of today, what do you see that's similar and also different than the work you were doing in the last century?
Well, I think there's a broader, by broader I mean across racial and ethnic and gender groups, set of activities that are going on that are good. I think the women's movement is a good effort. I think the effort among Hispanics on issues related to immigration, I think a large segment of the African-American community, especially the political leadership, is watching the whole effort surrounding the national leadership of immigration. We feel badly about the way children have been treated. We think that the leadership of the nation has done just a poor thing. We are a country of immigrants. I work at the gym, even though I'm 85 years of age, I still go to the gym at least 3 or 4 days a week. And I tell my colleagues at the gym, many who are retired, former white businessmen, successful, in the discussion we had one day, almost all of them had parents or grandparents who came from some other country to America. So I said, we are a country of immigrants. The only immigrant group that really was not an immigrant group were African Americans. We were brought here on the slave ships and treated in a very brutal way, with more than, it's estimated, 20 million blacks from Africa who lost their lives during the Middle Passage. So, I mean, if we want to talk about the kind of America that this country has become, it is a nation of immigrants. And we should be fair and just, treat everyone in a just manner. The other is fair voting. Voting rights needs to be monitored in some states. In some states, it's not an issue. That's what Dr. King gave a lot of time to. But a year before his death, Dr. King's death, he wrote Lyndon Baines Johnson, President Johnson, a note. And Andy Young and Dr. King met with President Johnson. He mentioned, "Well, maybe I should try to pass an anti-lynch bill." No, Dr. King said, "No, what we want is a civil rights bill." And that's what we eventually got. And you know what's so amazing? I am a sports fan, and I follow Michigan State sports very much. And when I see blacks playing for Ole Miss, football that is, and basketball too, because Mississippi was really a very brutal and angry state for blacks from a civil rights standpoint. Even today, at my old age of 85, I'm amazed to see black males playing sports for Ole Miss, no conflict, attending class, walking across campus. Because when I was working for Martin Luther King back in the 60s, a black person did not go on the campus of Ole Miss unless you were going there to clean, working as a cleaning person, a maid or a janitor. That's all you could do. You didn't dare put a foot on the campus. And so times have changed, but as Martin Luther King Jr. would say, we yet have a lot to do and a long ways to go. The fair treatment of everyone in America must be a major goal. Social justice was always a major goal. That's why I enjoy my work so much at Michigan State. It gave me a chance to grow and develop and work for freedom. Even when I was at Michigan State, I still, every now and then, would hop on a plane and go south and work with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And the college, James Madison College, is one of the colleges within the university committed to social justice. And that's what I'm here doing today. I'm giving a lecture sponsored by several units, the School of Social Work, the President's Office, James Madison College, are all supportive of my work, and I appreciate that very much. So Michigan State's a great place, and I really appreciate you giving me an opportunity to do a shout-out for a university that brought me in and gave me a chance to get a PhD, which I finished in December, I think, of 1962, and allowed me to go on and continue to work for social justice. The university never said, don't do this, don't do that, when it related to social justice on campus, off campus in East Lansing, and in the larger society working with Martin Luther King Jr.
Dr. Green, we're asking people all around the state the same question, but this is my chance to ask someone who was an associate of Dr. Martin Luther King. And here is the question. How would Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. feel about America today?
His concern would be to do what we can to make sure that there is a strong social justice strategy nationally here in America, that black, white, Hispanics, Native Americans, Asians, that we all come together and work together as brothers and sisters. Martin Luther King Jr. said, it's not enough to talk about brotherhood. I want you to be my brother. It's not enough to talk about sisterhood. I want you to be someone's sister. Someone's sister and brother in the name of social justice. So King would, he would be amazed at some of the progress that's been made in America, especially Barack Obama as president. I don't think King dreamed that would ever happen. I never dreamed that we would have an African-American as president of the United States. That was a major step, and I think it gave hope to a lot of other young minorities and women today. Look at the people who are declaring their intention to run for president of the United States. I think many are saying, if Barack Obama did it in America, I can do it. And so you have women, minority women, majority women, minority men, some declaring their intentions to possibly run for the top leadership position in this country. I think that would be amazing to Martin Luther King Jr. But King would have a keen eye on how young people are treated in America. King would be looking at the treatment of women in our society, the treatment of immigrants, the treatment of the poor. So King would be surprised at the progress we've made, but he would be disappointed in some of the things that are happening today from a leadership standpoint. King would never think that a president, any president, would make negative comments about other political leaders, about women, about minorities. King knew Lyndon Baines Johnson would never do that. John Fitzgerald Kennedy, President Bush, H.R. Bush, they would never utter things demeaning to a population, demeaning to a person. They would never do that. King would be disappointed in that.
Robert Green, Dean Emeritus, Michigan State University. I want to thank you very, very much for speaking with us on Stateside today.
You're welcome, and may all of you out there in Radio Land have a happy and a pleasant and a good, happy Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Thank you all.
Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Bob Scott. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Today's contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Sarah Leeson, Bella Isaacs, and Rosie Jaffrey. Special thanks to Sarah Swick, Bryce Huffman, and Kayla Fawn for gathering thoughts from around the state for this Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.